Good morning. Welcome. We will call the Legislative Task Force on Child Protection to order. Welcome. Thank you very much. What a great turnout. Before we do the introduction of the task force members, and especially our newest member, I would just like to have the approval of the minutes from January 19th of 2018, if anybody would like to make that motion. Thank you. Representative Carisha moves. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Carisha.
Yes.
It's very good to be here. I am. This is my first time back in probably 3 years, maybe, perhaps, 2-3 years. And Representative Carisha and myself and Representative Mulry and Senator Sharon were the first four legislators that started with the Governor Dayton's Child Protection Task Force. And I always say it was bittersweet. It was the best and the worst task force I ever sat on. We did a tremendous amount of work over the interim, and we really drilled down. I was on, I believe the same subcommittee as you.
I was on training. You were on
screening. I was on screening and transparency, right, with Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz.
Correct.
And we really worked hard, came up with our 99 recommendations. I'm anxious to find out. I'm going to be playing a little bit of catch-up in this realm right now to figure out where we are with all those recommendations, what we've implemented, and how they're doing. With that, though, I would first like to just have an introduction by the members and who's sitting at the table here, and perhaps a little bit about yourself. Representative Carisha, I'll start with you.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Rosen. And, yes, it's nice to have you back. As the two that were on that committee, that continuity is very important. So I have also been involved with this since the beginning of the governor's task force, and before that was very involved with early childhood education and issues along those lines. And as elections go and people come and go with retirements, we are the only two left from that committee. So it's passing it on to the next generation. The comment I would say is this issue, as gut-wrenching and as hard as it can be, has so many different complexities, and it has never been a partisan issue, never. It has been people who've looked at this and understand that the well-being of our children are the most important, and while we may have different conversations on how that happens and how it should be implemented to protect those children, I'm very proud of the folks that I've stood side by side with on both sides of the aisle and in both bodies. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carisha. My correction, 93 recommendations, not 99. Yes, Mark, go ahead.
I'm Mark Laliberty. I am the CA in the House for the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. This is my first meeting staffing this particular task force.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's good to be back with everybody. I am Representative Peggy Bennett. I represent 27A, which is Albert Lea and larger parts of southern Minnesota, kind of a neighbor to Senator Rosen. And I've been on this particular task force since it began. I am a former elementary school teacher of 33 years. I love kids. It's been a joy to serve on this task force, and also really an education, too, to see this part of working with kids. So I'll look forward to our continued work.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and everybody. So Representative Dave Pinto from the southwestern part of St. Paul. So folks are familiar with University of St. Thomas and McAllister and St. Kate's, that area. I serve outside the legislature as a prosecutor of gender violence, domestic violence, sexual exploitation, sex trafficking, which has a connection to many of the issues raised in the committee. And have a particular focus in the legislature on early childhood issues, helping to make sure that every child gets off to a great start, which obviously connects with this as well. So many thanks.
Oh, welcome. Thank you. Representative Moran.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and my fellow colleagues. My name is Rena Moran, State Representative from District 65A right here in St. Paul, representing the historical Rondo community, Midway, Frogtown, a little part of the North End and Cathedral Hill. Some of my background is in early childhood education. I worked in that field for about 15 years while also raising my own kids, my mother and myself. I am one of the original Legislative Task Force members who also watched the Governor Task Force really closely as the 93 recommendations came out of that body, but glad to be here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran.
I'm Sarah Sunderman. I cover child protection and other HHS issues in House Research.
Wonderful. Welcome. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is my first year on this task force. I represent Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, and have a 40-year history of working in mental health, so I've come across this issue quite a bit. I'm also a registered nurse.
Very great to have you on here, your expertise. Senator Johnson, and thank you so much. You are our newest member, and thank you very much. I'm very excited to work with you.
I am. Thank you very much, Senator Rose and Kresha, for inviting me to be part of this. I appreciate that. So I represent Northwest Minnesota, close to the Canadian border in North Dakota, and I've got three young children, a 6, a 4, and a 2-year-old. They're over at Grandma and Grandpa's house. Well, my wife and I are down here today. So appreciate the opportunity to be here and something that is clearly near and dear to my heart. So, again, thank you for asking me to be on the task force.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Andrew Matthews. I represent Senate District 15. My hometown is Mille Lacs, and I have all or large parts of Mille Lacs, Sherburne, and Benton counties, and I have small parts in Wright, Morrison, and Kennebec counties in east central Minnesota. This is my second year on the task force, and I am grateful to be here. We tackle a lot of important issues here, and we've been dealing with a growing issue with this with a number of my families that are some in my district and others throughout the state. And I have some advocates who have been working with some families in my district here in the audience today. They have a keen interest in making sure that we develop and refine a system that does right by our children and by our families. And I'm grateful for the chance to be here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Matthews. Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks also to Representative Kresha. I've always valued the work of this committee. I'm new to this committee, but I did have to, as Finance Chair of the HHS Budget Committee, had to deal with the recommendations that came out of the first iteration of this committee, and worked really hard with all of the members that we're serving, and really took this issue seriously. I represent Senate District 11, which I describe as most of the I-35 corridor between Duluth and the Twin Cities, the deep rural part of that, Pine, Carlton counties, the other half of Kennebec County, and a little chunk of St. Louis, just enough that the Rangers consider me a range legislator when they need a vote. Other than that, it's just a little rural chunk of the county. But I also have a long history in working in child welfare issues. It's one of the things that I did in my business ahead of for two and a half decades prior to my legislative service, was help states and counties restructure and refinance their health and human service agencies. Quite a bit of work in the child welfare and the Title IV-E realm. So I came with a passion and some pretty relevant experience, and have really tried to work. And I want to echo Representative Kresha's opening statements that the work of this really does, it's not bipartisan, it's nonpartisan. It transcends politics, and we may have difference of opinion about what we should do, but they don't even fall on partisan lines. I mean, we really have to take the welfare of our children very seriously, and we have a lot of work to do. Mm-hmm. And so I've always appreciated the perspective of this committee.
And Senator Laurie, you were very supportive of all the recommendations, the work that Senator Sharon and I were trying to do back then, and that we did get accomplished. So, yes, absolutely. And thank you for mentioning that, Representative Kresha. That is, I think, the foundation of this this task force, for sure. Ms. Pontius, and I would like to first say congratulations She will be retiring in 10 days, and she's going to be greatly missed. What a wealth of knowledge and experience, and you might get a phone call once in a while when you're near retirement, but I'm very excited for you. This is a whole new life for you, so well-deserved.
Well, yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I've been working in this area, child protection and the Child Abuse Reporting Act, since I think the 1985 session.
Wow.
So it's been a while, and it's always been an issue that's really been compelling for me. And the system's come a long way, but it has a long way to go. Mm-hmm. And it's constant attention and caring from legislators and the public communities that makes it work and hopefully move on. And this is actually my last commission hearing, of course, and I think after my last committee or commission hearing in the legislature. So feeling a little nostalgic today.
Absolutely. A little sad, too, for me. I really value everything you've done for us.
Thank you.
You've been like the point guard on a lot of these issues. And so, Ms. Primo, you're going to be the point guard. Is that correct? Please introduce yourself.
Priyanka Primo, Senate Counsel, and I'll be taking over Kathy's role.
Wonderful. Ms. White?
Joan White, Senate Counsel, Health and Human Services Reform Committee.
Great. Mr. Cotter?
John Cotter, I'm Senator Rosen's Legislative Assistant.
Brian Perro, Committee Administrator for the Senate Finance Committee.
Great. Absolutely. Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thought with the new member that we have on, and welcome, Senator, and others, and, of course, you retaining the role of co-chair again, I think it's important to revisit our charter, what we can and can't do, and what our oversight and jurisdiction is of this committee. First of all, when the original impetus of this committee came together, it was to review and make sure that the 93 recommendations were being followed through. That was our charter. And in doing that, we also would take recommendations from those, and we broke them into budgetary items, legislative items, policy, rulemaking, and so forth. And the idea for us was to make sure that they were being implemented correctly and that we were shepherding that a bit. But also, if there was legislative pieces that were needed, that we could come together and we could help get those through the two bodies with the most understanding, because this can be a complicated issue. One thing that I do want to point out, and I think this is important because I don't want to set up false misconceptions of what this committee does, or this task force does, is we do not approve legislation. Nothing comes through here. We may review it and pass it on, but we're not a legislative committee in that regard. The other thing is, we are not an oversight to DHS. In terms of, I know there may be frustrations with the system, there may be things that are working well, things that are not. Those channels are reserved for working within the confines of the county and so forth. You'll hear, as we frequently do, there are people that are working through the system that may have a difference of opinion on the outcomes. And what we will do, or at least what I have always done, is to direct those to the DHS folks. And if you could raise your hand. Who are my DHS folks? I see Jane. This is an important point. Because of data protection and privacy, we can only know so much about a case. So when a case comes to us, we're going to refer it back to DHS, or we're going to refer it back to the organization that has jurisdictions, because that's where the data is housed. And I want to make sure that that's important, because I want people that are coming here with frustrations or conversations to know where their paths are towards resolution. And, of course, this can also, some of these things can end up in courts and so forth. That is not us. That is not us. Not to say that we can't help, or members in this committee, when concerns come to us, we can't point you in the right direction. But I want people to know what we can and can't do, and what our roles are, because I just want you to know what the expectations are. And so maybe you can help, too, with how you perceive the charter of this task force.
Thank you, Representative Crenshaw. I think that was very well said. And I look forward to, the recommendations. And I think it'll become quite obvious, the mission and what we're able to do in this task force. when you start looking at the recommendations and what's been implemented, how we proceed from there. So thank you for teeing that up. But with that, before I get started with the department, welcome, Senator Hayden. If you'd like to say just a little bit of something about yourself, and thank you for being on the task force.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Hayden. I represent Senate District 62, which is in the heart of South Minneapolis. And I have been on this task force for a while, since it kind of transferred over to the legislative side of things, and have a particular concern about the disproportionality of African-American children in the child protection system. And so care about all kids, but I think that there is a real issue there. And if we don't kind of fix it, I think a lot of the issues that we seem to have in communities of color will be exacerbated.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Absolutely. With that, we're going to start our next recommendations. It's the review, the implementation of our recommendations. Jamie Sorensen, who is with the Child Safety and Permanency Director for DHS, worked with Mr. Sorensen right from the very beginning. Very good to see you again, Mr. Sorensen.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Mr. Sorensen, before you get started, I want to make sure that we're on the right documents. If you can just point this out, which is this the right piece?
That's
the
correct.
The color-coded one that you're going to be working off of. And then the next piece is just a letter from.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Crisha.
May I ask Mr. Sorensen which marathons you've been running?
I actually just lost my task force weight, so I have returned to the original weight that I came to Minnesota at.
Oh, good for you. That's great. All right. Mr. Sorensen, if you would like to proceed with how you'd like to, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Sorensen, before you get started on this, can you just give a little background? You said where you came from, and that's when I first knew you, Representative Crisha, when you first came to Minnesota. Just give us a little history for some of the new members, too.
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, I came to Minnesota in 2012, so I've been here for almost 6 years. Worked at the Department of Human Services as the supervisor of the Research Evaluation Data Unit and also the training system, and then was the acting director in 2014, and then the director of the Child Safety and Permanency Division right around March 2015, the same time when the 93 Task Force Recommendations Report came out. In Wisconsin, I worked in the county Children and Family Services system. I worked at Eau Claire County and a very rural county, Barron County. I did Child Protective Services investigation, foster care, provided oversight to units that served kids with mental health issues, delinquency, developmental disabilities, and so have really done the gamut in terms of child welfare services in a county system. I'm also entering my second year as president of the APHSA, National Association of Public Child Welfare Administrators, and so monthly I convene child welfare leaders throughout the nation to talk about federal legislation and pressing national issues largely related to immigration, separation of children from parents, and certainly the Family Preservation Services Act. So in Minnesota, I've been involved in the system from the start of the Child Protection Task Force, have engaged and partnered with lots of our child welfare stakeholders around implementation of the recommendation, and looking forward to the conversation this morning and to understand from this committee the priorities that emerge from the conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Sorensen. Wonderful. Okay, proceed.
Since March 2015, I'd like to really highlight briefly what's happened in Minnesota's child welfare system in the past 3 to 4 years since implementation of these recommendations. In 2014, there were 12,172 kids that touched out-of-home care annually. And in 2017, 16,593 kids touched out-of-home care. And so that's a 20% 27% increase in just a very short time. So we've got a system that has really exploded for us here in Minnesota in terms of kids and out-of-home care. Part of what we have to think about in terms of out-of-home care is kids coming into the system contributes to that number, but kids also not exiting out-of-home care contributes to that problem. In 2013, the median days in care for kids was 175 days. And now in 2017, it's 297 days. And so there's lots of reasons for that. We know some of them. Some of them we still need to look further into. There's more American Indian children in care today than there was in 2014. Per 1,000 American Indian children, there were 90.7 in foster care in 2014. In 2017, there's 131 per 1,000. So quite a substantial increase. And again, that's an area where we have to be thinking about kids not exiting care. And that's a big contributor to the American Indian kids in care. More African-American children in care per rate per 1,000 in 2014, 17, and in 2017, 21.8. And so a small increase in terms of the number of African-American kids rate per 1,000. And then kids who are two or more races, and this can be any combination, including white kids, in 2014, 23 per 1,000 in care, and in 2017, 34 per 1,000 in care. So we've got a concern in the area around disproportionate representation of American Indian kids and African American kids and other kids of color in care. Children placed in 2017, 29% of children placed in 2017 were placed for the primary reason of parental drug use, and that's an extraordinary increase. And so we are seeing the heroin opioid epidemic actualized in that primary parental reason of placement into care. Yes.
Excuse me, Mr. Sorensen. Senator Hayden. Good.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Sorensen. That data that you were just reading, I don't think we have that in front of us. Is there a way that we could get that? I think those numbers are profound and extremely important.
Sure. I can share those. They are from the 2017 out-of-home placement annual report and the maltreatment annual report, and those are soon to be released. But I can share this information with you.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Sorensen.
In 2017, there were 84,000 reports of child maltreatment in Minnesota's child welfare system, and 45% of those reports were screened in, so 37,000 reports were screened in, and that's a significant increase. Since 2008, there has been a 75% increase in completed assessment and investigations, and that's not even a decade ago. Family assessments represent 58% of cases screened in, family investigations 38%, and so a small decrease in the number of family assessments, a small increase in the number of family investigations. At the same time, when we're talking about these recommendations, and I know this is a very long document to go through, there is some benefit to going through it in totality because this is the child welfare system. It's the pre-court portion of the child welfare system. There's a lot of interplay between many of the recommendations. And so when you make a change in one area and you implement something, you tend to see impacts in other areas. And so getting a full picture of the report, I think, allows one to best understand the system and the reform that we've been in.
Mr. Sorensen.
Yes.
Representative Crescia.
Sorry, Mr. Sorensen. I'm sure as we're hearing these numbers and I'm thinking through, because I'm familiar with the numbers from the previous year, you mentioned 84,000 reports for the, was that 2016, 2017?
2017.
2017, and that's up how much?
Mr. Sorensen.
It's up 75% from 2008.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you. And so, Mr. Sorensen, you said 47% were screened in, that means 53% were screened out. Do we have, and it could be in this report, but this is always something that we've been talking a lot about, is the rise of these reports. Do we have a breakdown of how those were reported and by what type of mandatory reporters?
Yes, we do.
Mr. Sorensen.
And
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason I ask is one of the things we're trying to get our hands around, or I've been trying to get our hands around, is are these reports reports that are safety net reports? In other words, are reporters such an example, like a teacher who can't find another service for these students or somebody they're interacting with, using this as the place that they know something will get done? And that's what I worry about, is that this system has become a catch-all. And just by looking at the screened in, screened out. So I'm wondering if we could break that down and if we can try to find that out, because I get one of the things I'm trying to get to is if there's a percentage of reports that are going in that could be done better in another program, or maybe it's a SNAP or another system that could help them, we get them out of this very expensive and onerous program. Does that make sense?
Mr. Sorensen.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreshaw, that does make sense. That's a good question. One of the things that I might recommend based on these numbers is the annual reports are soon to be released. I will distribute those to the committee when they're released, but we could also, on the agenda, if it's desired, include that as a presentation and get into some of those details of the numbers and the data and what's behind them once those are released.
Okay. When are those released, Mr. Sorensen?
It should be any day. I'm waiting for final approvals.
For the next hearing, then. Great. Senator Hayden.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Sorensen, to follow up with Representative Kreshaw, I think getting to that level of detail is really important. But to Ms. Sorensen, how would we know? Like, how would we know, Madam Chair, if someone is using the system as a catch-all? There were no other places for this child to go, and people were really concerned. Like, I'm trying to follow that through. Someone gets screened in. Does the person at the county says, well, don't know what else to do, so I'm just going to take them out the house because they need some services that they can't get? Like, how do we figure that out? Because it seems to me the rationale that county workers or county social workers are using, it's pretty clear guidelines of what they need to do if they're going to screen somebody in. So I'm being redundant. I'm just trying to figure out how would we know, to get at Representative Kreshaw's point.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. I think that's excellent. And to get clarifications, I think this the disparities geographically are different. I mean, there's for example, I know what your constituents are facing. I've looked in the numbers. In my area, for example, we'll have, and I don't want to be broad and general, but just to illustrate a point, I mean, we'll have groups of families where people will say, oh, they're going to go through the system. And the reason I bring this up is because it's not the county social workers who are making those. Remember, they're not making the reports. Somebody made that referral, some mandatory reporter. And what I see in my area, and I'll speak for my area, is someone will, a teacher or, remember, even a coach or a community member can report a family because they see or they feel something's not right there, rather than knowing right where to go. And my fear is what we've created in this system is it's really easy to call social services and have them go through the screened-in process. It's really hard to go to that family and say, what do you really need? What are you struggling with? Maybe you just lost your job. You know, maybe dad's going through a tough time. I mean, and I know this is oversimplification, but there was a time when social services was the last call, and the first call was you put your arm around your neighbor and say, hey, I see you lost your job. How do we get you through this? And so that's why I bring that level of distinction up, because I'm worried that in today's day of worrying about liabilities and all that, you just pick up the phone, you send them to the county, when I think we're too quick to that. So I want to take it one more step back, because as you were illustrating, the county social worker isn't making it. They're there, and they're just responding to X, whatever that can be. And I think that frankly, I think that's our problem right now, is getting our arms around that.
Yep.
Senator Hayden?
Madam Chair, Representative Kreshaw, I agree totally. Like, I'm with you. I'm just trying to figure out how we figure that out.
Yep, right. Okay.
Like, I don't get where how Mr. Sorensen or someone is going to make the determination that when the coach or the teacher or the librarian called, that there could have been another call to have been made to help this family upstream. I'm trying to figure out how do we figure that out. And the data that I know that we get is coming from when it's been reported and then the determination that's made when it's reported. So I'm trying to figure out how do we get upstream.
Right. And so apparently, Mr. Sorensen, we have some work to do when those reports come out. Representative Moran, do you have something?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Crisho and Senator Hayden, I think when we can look back at the 93 recommendations and the conversation that was at the table back in 2014, 2015, that the priority was that people would report, and they would report to, you know, child protection. And that's kind of like the process that we have created. And I do agree that there should be another place first, like some type of support that maybe some families do need before we go to the place where we are removing and pulling kids out of the system. But that is what has been created.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Representative Moran. Okay. With that, Mr. Sorensen, we do have some work that we are going to have to look at, I guess, when those recommendations come out. Thank you.
Sure. And Madam Chair, I appreciate those comments. As we continue the conversation this morning, I'll be talking about family preservation, Family First Preservation Services Act, which speaks exactly to your observation and comments, as well as the Administration on Children and Families priority of creating prevention as a core mission in child protection. And so I think it positions Minnesota for a different conversation about Minnesota's child welfare system. I share this information with you in terms of numbers and trends in the system as impact to implementation of partial impact to implementation of a number of the recommendations from the governor's task force. There's been a great deal of work done, and it would be time intensive to walk through this document in this committee hearing, and so I'm trying to summarize in a way that is a little more digestible. I do want to say that these recommendations reflect only a portion of our work in Minnesota's child protection system. That at the same time this work is happening, the Family First Preservation Services Act was passed, and I will talk about that in a little more detail coming up. But I want to talk about kind of the fiscal impact at this point in Minnesota's child welfare system as well. Now, as many of you will remember, in 2015, $23 million in state funding was added to Minnesota's child welfare system to address caseload ratios and to also fund services for kids and families. And that funding continues annually. In 2015, the cost of Minnesota's child welfare system was $429 million. And in 2017, the cost was $644 million. And so counties pay about $287 million of that, the feds pay about $160 million of that, and the state pays about $167 million of those funds. And so as we think about the growth in Minnesota's child welfare system, you know, I'm here to hopefully advocate this as a priority in terms of the need for additional state funds to complete some of the things that we've started in terms of implementation of these recommendations. And I'll go into a little more detail about a couple of those. One is in the area of workforce development. I think it's important to realize that there's still about a 20% rate of turnover in Minnesota's child welfare workforce, and this is disruptive and difficult for kids and families who really need the support of the system for safety and child well-being. It's also expensive to local child welfare agencies. And so as we look at efforts to stabilize the workforce and to try to make this job doable for those who are in the counties and the tribal agencies, we need to think about things like how quickly and effectively do we train them and what do we offer them as more advanced ongoing training. How do we address their caseload ratios so that what sits before them is doable and as they assess and try to serve. kids and families. And so, you know, we believe that that's foundationally one of the very important things that we need to do in Minnesota. Statutorily, it's required that county workers complete their foundation training within their first 6 months of employment. And in Minnesota, they're currently on a waiting list for the entire first 6 months of their employment, and they're completing training at a later date. Our system has not grown in terms of training efforts, and we are not able to meet the need at this time in Minnesota. We are not providing much at all in terms of advanced training.
Mr. Sorensen, why? Is there just not enough trainers, not enough people educated?
Madam Chair, there were about 400 new workers added to the system in 2015, turnover rate of about 20%, and there was not growth in Minnesota's child welfare training system. And so the need meets the ability to provide training at this point in time.
And Mr. Sorensen, can you, or is there somebody that can tell us who is doing the training, what sites, Minsky, University of Minnesota, where is that training
the foundation, Madam Chair, the foundation training?
You're right.
The foundation training happens throughout the state, and it is done by the department, by the child welfare training system currently.
Okay. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is as good a time as anything to remind the members. We had a training bill last year, and we need to bring that back up. And it was through the U of M. We had great support for that. And the reason I bring this up is because that was a huge priority. And you just heard right there why I pushed so hard. And I know, Senator Matthews, you were my co-author in the Senate. But I'll just, you know, I can't say this strongly enough. This has got to be a priority to get this training. I mean, 6 months is inexcusable to, and it's no fault because we just have to get more training, and we have an opportunity.
Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Kreisha stated a lot of what I was going to say as one of my priorities in taking that bill was recognizing the need that maybe one of the early remedies for dealing with the cases that we see, and then you know, it's the problem cases that call my office and talk about how they feel like CPS is not treating the families correctly. That's when they are usually calling me or other members here on this table. My goal was if we can improve the training on the front end, maybe we have better guidelines so we know when do we go in and have a high level of intervention and when do we know that another smaller remedy is sufficient and we can avoid a number of these calamities that we end up with that end up in my office. So I was also pushing with Representative Kreisha on that bill. I hope we can do that again. I want to thank the U of M for working with me with that, and we're going to go back and tackle that one again, hopefully next session.
Thank you. Mr. Sorensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Additionally, and I'm referring to items that are in the task force recommendations. Another area where I'm concerned and I believe we need investment is we need to better support our current initiative tribes, White Earth and Leech Lake. The appropriations for them were established in 2005. They were delegated as initiative tribes and 2008, and the funding for them has not increased. And I'm learning things about Leech Lake, like they have their original computers from 2008. They work in a space where it isn't regulated in terms of air conditioning and heat, and so it's over 85 degrees in the summertime. That caseloads are very high, and so we haven't grown with them and positioned them for success. In addition, in the task force recommendation is the expansion of initiative tribes, and we have been working with Mille Lacs and Red Lake to prepare them and plan for them as initiative tribes, and so hopefully bringing that forward this year for this legislative session. That is important to the tribal agencies and the tribes. It's what they think is best for their children, and that's important to us. And then Additionally, we are really revisioning our continuous quality improvement work and our technical support for counties and tribal agencies, as well as the program improvement plans and systems that we use with county agencies. And we've been working with the Center for States, which is out of the Administration for Children and Families, to help do that work because that's no cost to Minnesota, and we've been working with them for about 18 months to revision and do that work, and it's been a successful endeavor. We've also been working with the Center for States on talking about how Minnesota talks about child safety and plans for child safety and the tools that we use toward that end. Collaborative safety, I believe there was an invitation to members of this committee to attend collaborative safety training last year. I know a few people were able to attend. If that's of interest, we can offer that again. But collaborative safety is a model that we embedded, born out of the task force recommendations for fatality near fatality review, that does a very thoughtful systemic review, taking science from aviation and nuclear science and embedding it into child welfare, social service systems, and a very methodical mapping of where in our system we're needing to focus our resources and intention towards improvement. And also I want to mention we're doing, going back to continuous quality improvement, which collaborative safety is a part of, we're also continuing to review screenings from counties on a monthly basis. And we review screenings in proximity to when the decision is made, so that if we don't believe it's in line with our guidelines or statutes, we get back to the county and have them revisit the screening decision. Madam Chair.
Representative Warren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to the collaborative safety, I think that was the group that I participated in that process. And so I'm going to be aligning myself with Mr. Sorensen, that as a committee here, a legislative task force who is working specifically around child protection and how we move forward to create safe environments, not only for children and family, but for staff within DHS so they can be effective in doing their work, I would like to encourage us as a task force to have that group come in and to participate, for those who were not able to participate in that training. It is really bringing a new perspective around what safety looks like, and I think it would be helpful for us as a task force to be a part of that training.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Krisha and I will work on that. I think that's a great idea. Thank you, Mr. Sorensen.
Madam Chair, a few more comments that I would make is with regard to the recommendations from the Governor's Task Force. We're happy to meet with people individually and answer questions or to try to explain pieces of work that we've done with them. Happy to provide, you know, summaries or information that is most helpful to attempting to wrangle this big set of recommendations. So that really entails my presentation on the recommendations, unless there are questions. I would offer a couple of items that may be of interest to the committee for future agendas. Even though we believe that we need funding to expand the child welfare training system, that doesn't mean that we haven't done work to improve it. And with the work of the Center for Advanced Studies in Child Welfare at the University of Minnesota, the department, counties, child welfare agencies, other stakeholders throughout the state, we have tried to actualize Minnesota's child welfare practice model through the development of knowledge and skills competencies, kind of basic, advanced, and for supervisors. And so that work has been completed and widely embraced throughout the state, and we are currently in the process of working on getting that out, getting people versed in them and how they can implement those. That may be an item of interest to this committee in terms of a presentation to delve into the knowledge and skills competencies that are highlighted in Minnesota's child welfare practice model. There's also a pilot that's been happening that was funded by the legislature in the last session called Minor Connect. It's DHS in Hennepin County, and it's a strategy with unaccompanied homeless youth who are a little older. And something that we're excited about and something that we think is, as we implement it as a pilot, revealing youth and us kind of locating and finding youth that maybe didn't define themselves as unaccompanied or homeless because they thought they had a plan at a friend's house on a couch or whatever the case may be. So that may be of interest for future committee meetings. And then also there are some very effective family and children drug courts in Minnesota. And I don't know if that is an area of interest for this committee, but some very good evidence-based practice that's occurring in counties like Dakota and others.
Thank you, Mr. Soren. That's really good a review. And I just keep reminding myself, no question is a stupid question because I've been out of it for a couple of years. But you've done a tremendous amount of work. Members, I know I'm going to take this home and really review this list of the planning document. It's very impressive. And I wish we received more information like this in our work on a daily basis. This is very good stuff. Is there any questions for Mr. Sorensen on this issue? Great. With that, we are going to change to the Family First Preservation Services Act. You do have the handout. And Ms. Summerfield, welcome. Are you giving this presentation or Mr. Sorensen? I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, no, I'm just up here to move the PowerPoint along.
I see. Okay.
Thank you.
If you would like to introduce yourself, though.
Certainly. My name is Jennifer Summerfield. I'm the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services, and today I am the Media Coordinator.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Welcome. Mr. Sorensen.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'll start by just a quick reminder. I know that everyone knows this, but Minnesota is a state-supervised, county-administered child welfare system. And when I talk about the child welfare system, I'm talking about the child welfare agencies at the local and tribal level, guardian ad litems, county attorneys, the courts, and law enforcement. Decisions are made through multidisciplinary team convenings in lots of places in the child welfare system, and no one is acting alone. We all influence each other greatly, and when we think about things like the Family First Preservation Services Act and we think about task force recommendations, we need to think broadly about the child welfare system with its varying stakeholders. This is a piece of federal legislation that passed, was signed into law February 9th, 2018. It is a very large piece of legislation, and we here in Minnesota have been working very quickly and very hard at trying to implement and meet the timelines for many of the technical components of the act that are already requirements and in implementation. As I talk about this act, I'd like to take two paths. One is kind of the technical implementation elements of Family First that relates to Title IV-E funding, our Title IV-E plan, and then kind of statutory and other practice modifications that we've had to make in Minnesota. The other pathway is around the conversation that was happening a bit earlier with Representative Cresha and Senator Hayden's remarks Representative Moran's remarks around kind of earlier intervention and what do we want in Minnesota for our child welfare system? How do we have that conversation about early intervention, meeting families a bit more upstream with our helper and connected roles versus our protective and safety roles? And so I think that's one of the conversations that we have the opportunity to have in Minnesota, and I think it's a very exciting conversation. That particular conversation is really commencing for us more officially on November 1st. We asked Casey Family Programs, which is a national, very reputable child welfare organization, a think tank in many regards across the nation, to come into Minnesota and to convene counties, tribal agencies, the state, Cashew, and a variety of other stakeholders to begin to talk about what does this act provide for us in Minnesota in terms of an opportunity to build a prevention and early intervention system for child welfare. And so that's an exciting conversation and one that we'd like to be in dialogue with this committee about on an ongoing basis. The more technical elements.
Mr. Sorensen, will this group talk about what you want to do to create new optional prevention funding ideas? And they will dive down that deep into how you're doing the group foster care, but most important, I'm zeroing in on the prevention funding.
Most definitely, yes. Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. So they'll bring to the table what other states are doing, or they'll develop what we already implement here and work off.
What Casey Family Programs will do is they are convening these kinds of work groups in a number of states, and so they will bring the innovations and learnings from other states throughout the nation to Minnesota and share that information with us to see if there are models that fit for us. They will also assist us in conversations around our funding structure and the 4E opportunities within Families First to see how Minnesota can begin developing that prevention infrastructure in those domains around mental health, substance abuse, and parental supports that Minnesota has an array of services broadly accessible and funded through 4E for kids and families throughout the state.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Sorensen, so I've also been involved starting to hear on the Family First Prevention and seeing it come through some legislative groups that I participate in. Here's my worry, and I want to just make sure I get this stated. What is the process we're going to have to get all of us on the same page? I'll just say it up front. What I don't think would be helpful is if we have three or four bills in both bodies traveling all over the place with different ideas on how to take advantage of the Family First Prevention Act. And I've been having some conversations with the counties and MACSA, as well as how do we all get on the same page? Because my worry is, as I look around the country, we have states that that are driven by their departments that have no county structure like we do, and they're going to have the ability to take advantage of this very quickly and move. And there will be some money that's out there that I don't want us to lose out on. I also understand if we get too far ahead of our skis, you know, we're doing some things that may not get funded down the road because of risk. But my real concern is, are we going to be coordinated? I mean, we're coming in November 1st, and the traditions that I've seen is bills start flying January 15th. And I just want some coordination. I want us to all understand how we're going to get to that point on the horizon, because that's important.
Mr. Sorensen.
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, there have been ongoing discussions to date with MACSA county representatives. The November 1st convening and the work with Casey Family Programs is designed to better bring us together in a shared understanding and vision around the technical and kind of envisioning elements of Family First for Minnesota. I appreciate your comment and your concern. I share it to some extent and am striving from where we sit to try to bring people together in the conversation so that there can be a very planful implementation of Family First and its best expression in Minnesota. There are unique funding pressures in Minnesota. One of the kind of unsaid realities of Family First is that in many regards it is shifting the expenditure of group care and those group settings from the federal reimbursement to the state level reimbursement. And we know that in Minnesota the counties largely fund those group care settings. And so That fiscal impact is something that we have to be vigilant to, and that will, I think, be a variable in how we are positioned to move forward with some of the prevention efforts and the funds that are available in that regard. And so I'm pensive about making decisions at the state level without our tribal and county partners at the table, because the impact could be broadly shared, and we have to be very cautious and vigilant to how we move forward.
Representative Kreshaw, and then Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't want to put this all on your shoulders. I want to raise it to you because I know you're going to be a driving force in understanding this. I will also look to my legislative colleagues and say we have to communicate on this. We absolutely do. Because every party we know has a vested interest, and I know Hennepin will have their ideas, Ramsey will have their ideas, the Count Maxa will have their ideas, DHS will have their ideas. I have my ideas, and as well, I mean, we're all going to look for ways to take advantage of this. We will have to pull the reins back and make sure we're in tight communication, because I see this as a huge opportunity for us to solve the things that we've talked about. I also see it as a huge liability to just start putting more patchwork onto an already complicated quilt. So that's what I would offer.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I too worry about getting on the same page. I wanted to sort of give a little bit of perspective. I mean, from DHS, you know, they're going to be putting together proposals for a transition. I mean, we have, you know, an election coming up in a couple of weeks. And to take best advantage of Families First, you know, honestly, it'll take a state investment as well. And so I just to recognize that the people in front of us here aren't going to be able to really go too far in telling us what the right path is. But I think, Representative Kreshaw, you're absolutely right that this group should stay in close contact, because the idea of moving Title, you know, 4E federal funding opportunities into the prevention world is really transformative, and I was really glad that Mr. Sorensen, you know, dove in that earlier conversation that we had that Senator Hayden started. It really is getting at, you know, what do we do when families present and they're faced with challenges, and having the opportunity to invest in those family supports with a new federal funding opportunity is critical in our ability to really get ahead of the curve on some of this work. But it's going to take an investment on the state part, on Minnesota as well. I mean, whether it's the state or the counties, I mean, we're going to have to, you know, figure out who puts up the non-federal share. But to point one here in this slide, that prevention funding, the feds are saying that they're willing to step up and take 50 cents on the dollar in Minnesota's instance and help us build these systems. It is a really exciting opportunity, and I think that staying on the same page and working with a new administration in this is going to be critical. But I do want to be respectful of the position that our current administration representatives are in front of us here. They're going to have some proposals, presumably, to present to a transition team, and we'll see where it goes. Okay.
Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to ask a question before, you know, that you then asked and brought up was whether now or if you are sending out information. I too wanted to drill down on these two points that were mentioned here, because they do look intriguing, and it seems to all come around with the situations I'm following. It does seem to come around to follow the money and making sure that it's being used in the right way. And I keep thinking of an old adage a teacher of mine used to drill into us, going, define your terms. So what's the actual proposal when we say prevention funding? What will that look like? Is it actually going to help with what our goals with prevention are and the group foster care situation? So if you have a timeline on when you think you can get more of this information to us, let me know, but I too am greatly interested in drilling down on these two points.
Thank you, Senator Matthews. Mr. Sorensen, can you just briefly go through the dollars amount of this act and the time frame on that, some of the you know, cliff notes on the stipulations. I know you're going to go through that, but
sure, Madam Chair, Senator Matthews, I can't go through a dollar amount. This is, you know, a federal appropriation that a lot of new money isn't infused into. I can share with you that annually Minnesota gets about $70+ million in federal Title IV E funds. And what we are actually waiting for in terms of Senator Matthews' comments about defining terms is actually the federal ACF was to, in October, provide a list of approved prevention services to states nationally. And they did not meet that timeline, and so we don't know what those clearinghouse of approved prevention interventions are at this time. They have indicated that they will provide them sometime late fall. That's really important for us to see what's on that clearinghouse mm-hmm. list and then to map to see what it is we have in Minnesota. And that will allow us to better understand, do we have the services available in Minnesota to kids and families that we can begin to bill Title IV E for at the 50% reimbursement rate?
Senator Matthews.
Briefly, thank you, Madam Chair. Can you refresh me on ACF is?
The Federal Administration of Children and Families.
Oh, right, right.
Great, thank you. Okay. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And from the legislative side, I've been engaged with 25 other states. And just to hear from what legislators are talking about, and everything you said is correct, we started meeting back in July with the anticipated guidelines to come out in October, which obviously we would have all been surprised if the feds had done that. So for the members here, the guidelines are still very vague. In fact, nobody's really sure. But here's one of the things I do want to ask. Have we filed the paperwork to say that we're going to go forward, or have we filed paperwork saying that we're going to delay?
Mr. Sorensen.
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, we have not filed any paperwork, and we have not made a determination yet. It's one of the first things that we want to talk about at the November 1st convening. DHS at the state does not want to make that determination alone without having a really thoughtful conversation with the county and tribal agencies. I think the desire is to bring family first in sooner rather than later, and so that will be the bent of the conversation from my approach anyway.
Representative Grisham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so my personal opinion in talking to these, I would err on the side of pushing forward. And the reason I say that, and if you're looking for any guidance, and I'm sure there's others, but from the conversations we were having with other states, the back and forth was, do we be at the beginning or do we wait at the end? And what I surmise from that is those states that take the steps can help write the guidelines. And I believe Minnesota's been a leader in this area, and we can continue to be. And so if you had my vote, I would say please push forward. And as a legislative body, if we decide to pull the reins back, we can always do that. But it's going to be very hard for us to come into February and March and say, oh, we missed the deadline for pushing forward. Now we have to wait another year. So that's where I would be, and then I would fully support wherever you end up. But I just that's a perspective that I thought I'd share.
Thank you. Okay, great.
And Madam Chair.
Mr. Sorensen. Senator Lori.
Back on that, back up the slides one more time. I mean, I think maybe just for, if you could go to that, yeah. I mean, I think one and two here are kind of different because number one uh-huh. is, you know, going to be driven by a state investment and we can, you know, get a 50-cent match on whatever investment we make. Number two is actually sort of a risk in terms of federal funding for Minnesota. I mean, we have a lot of children that are receiving a match for the group foster care settings that they're in currently. So, I mean, I think that's one of the big budget challenges that we have to work through in deciding. And I do hope that we can move forward as well because, you know, this opportunity for moving in this prevention space is really tremendous. But we have to recognize that it comes at a great risk of loss of federal funding if we don't figure out collectively
how to come into compliance with this group foster care setting, because we have I don't know the percentages right now, but we have a lot of kids that are in those settings today, and it's a blended state federal, you know, 50 cents on the dollar match there too. So I mean, that's going to have to be a part of the equation as we move forward, and I just want everybody to understand that I'm not making the decision myself or weighing in, and I hope that we are able to take that leap. But
Representative Crenshaw.
And I'm sorry, I don't want to drag this out. Well, this is very important. I mean, I can't understate or I can't overstate the importance of getting this right. I mean, this is an opportunity for us that, frankly, as a body of legislators, if we get this and we do it, this will be one of those things we hang our hats on. The other thing, and the conversations we have when you talk about the group foster care and the prevention funding, how this is made possible, as I understand it, and please clarify me, is the way the feds are getting this done is we're moving money from the Conaggregate care into prevention. What the feds, at least the commissioners that I have spoken to and that came to our meetings, were very clear in they want to see kids out of group foster care homes, and they want to see those families secured, which is something we have talked about many, many, many times as a solution. So I just can't overstate enough how important this will be for us and an opportunity that we have in front of us.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Crenshaw may have just stated my question or concern. When looking at group foster care, which is a place that we want to try to minimize, putting children in group foster care specifically. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about, you know, when you talk about strictly limiting the federal reimbursement for children placement, what do that mean? What do that really look like?
Mr. Sorensen.
Madam Chair, I think, you know, my response gets to Senator Lori's comment and Representative Crenshaw and Representative Moran's question. And, you know, in Minnesota, for congregate care, which includes group homes and residential care centers, we pull down in Minnesota about $7 million annually for the reimbursement for those types of placements. And so, if we're looking at that $7 million as, you know, being restricted because we have different rules for the types of facilities kids can be placed in, they'd be called QRTPs or Qualified Residential Treatment Placements, I believe is what QRTP stands for. And there's a bunch of elements with that. It has to be an accredited facility. They have to have 24-hour nursing care staff. They have to have a really child-specific plan of treatment. They have to engage the family in a certain manner. And the child has to have a complete assessment determining the appropriateness of the placement setting within 2 weeks of placement. And so, you know, when we look at Minnesota and we look at nationally, this is the trend. We know that accrediting bodies are going to have a backlog of requests for accreditations. And so, I mean, we just need to be watching those kinds of things and determining in Minnesota, are we going to have QRTPs available for these kinds of placements? And so it's a understanding of what's going to happen with that potential $7 million, what will remain of that. And should we not get that federal reimbursement, who's going to absorb that cost? In Minnesota, it's largely the county agencies. And then balance that with, do we believe we have a clearinghouse of preventative services that are going to allow us referral and pull down a federal Title IV office dollars to kind of balance that out? And so I think that's kind of the sweet spot we're trying to get to when we're waiting for information to come in still. From ACF and for our state conversations to determine, you know, what is the time for Minnesota to move forward with Family First.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. This is a fascinating conversation as you start to kind of dig into it. But, Madam Chair, Mr. Sorensen, do we have a sense of how many of the kids or the young people are young folks that are in foster care in these congregate foster care settings are in a TPR status? And where I'm going, and to help me if I'm going down the wrong way, I'm trying to figure out prevention, just in a very basic way, is like upstream services, trying to reunite them with their families, trying to do all of the things that we think will help them stay out of or get out of the congregate foster care, or the foster care system in particular, this system. But what about those children whose parents' parental rights have been terminated? Like, what does that look like, and how do we deal with that?
Mr. Sorensen.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, you know, that's a really good question that I think we need to spend time thinking about in Minnesota. In general, the kids that are in congregate care settings are maybe older. And in Minnesota, they may be in the behavioral health system. They may be in the juvenile justice system. And there's a portion that are also in Minnesota's child protection system. I think it is going to be an area needing some analysis, because off the top of my head, I don't know how the experience will play out for those particular youth as we think about implementing Family First in Minnesota.
Senator Hayden.
So, Madam Chair, so it sounds like we have a lot of thinking to do and a lot of work to do, and I think about Representative Cresha, I think we should move forward, but I think that we should move forward really cautiously and smartly and put as many heads together and as many communities to think about it. We have an extremely diverse state and different levels of facilities and different levels of resources to help with this process. And I would hesitate that we don't oversimplify what this looks like. And it may be simple in some cases and in some parts of the state, but it sounds pretty complicated, the system that we have. And I recognize that we've changed the federal law, but we really need to think about what this looks like, because as we're looking into the things that I've been diving into around the disproportionality of kids of color, in particular, your report said that American Indians, African-American kids in the system. And then I'm reminded of some that are in the room today that are starting to look at the decision points and the severity and what happens to those children in the system versus other kids. We have a disparity in terms of punishment, right? Or lack of a better term, and what happens, what the adjudication process is. So if we have a disproportionate amount of black kids or American Indian kids in the TPR status, that then is going to have an implication on where the prevention dollars go and what they can be used for. I don't know what the prevention dollars can be used for. I haven't seen that bucket of services and what that looks like. Maybe it could be looked at helping kids who age out of the system and continue to support them as they go into adulthood. I don't know if that's a textbook prevention, but a lot of kids that I know and a lot of young folks that I know that are in the system and have gone through this and their folks have lost their parental rights are in that status. So I just think that we have to really put all our heads together and walk, you know, cautiously, and then, Madam Chair, really not to oversimplify what this might look like for us in the future.
Very well said. Thank you, Senator Hayden. Mr. Sorensen.
As I look at this PowerPoint and I consider the time that we're at, I mean, I think the heart of the conversation around Family First Prevention Services Act has really happened in this dialogue. There is a necessity for us to be vigilant on all fronts as it relates to congregate care and the array of prevention services. And the fiscal impact and opportunities for Minnesota. I think the technical implementation elements of Family First, but also the vision conversation, so that we use this as an opportunity to move our interventions and our work upstream to be more helpful to kids and families versus just having the deeper end child protective services system available. And then the importance of the continued dialogue with this committee. And so I guess I don't know that there's much else to present on in terms of Family First at this time, other than perhaps questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sorensen. Are there further questions? Obviously, this is something that we'll be working on, and preferably before the session starts, too, so we can be up and moving. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Sorensen.
If I could also just send my regards to the committee on behalf of my assistant commissioner, Nikki Farrago. She took Jim Koppel's place. For those of you who know Nikki, know that Assistant Commissioner Farrago is very committed to children. She's very committed to the experience of American Indian children and families in the state of Minnesota. And it's been a pleasure to have her as a colleague for the past 6 years and to now work with her as Assistant Commissioner. And she's not able to be here today, so I wanted to share her regards. Oh, and also, since the legislative task force, we have really done a great deal of work at the department, and we have a very, I think, talented, stable, committed team of leadership at the Division in Child Safety and Permanency. And so as these committee hearings continue, hopefully you'll have an opportunity to meet some of that leadership team.
Thank you, Mr. Sorensen. That's very, very nice that you said that. And I would actually like to add on to that and thank publicly the governor. This is a task force that he created, and it's been an honor to serve on it. And as he is leaving, he can look back on the work that's been done by this, by many. It's not only the department, you and your team, Mr. Sorensen, the task force, but all the other people that came and have really contributed to this issue. So I just would like to publicly thank Governor Dayton for that. Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Now we are going to have just a brief, very brief apparently, review of our legislation that was passed in 2018 by Ms. White and Ms. Sundeman. Ms. White.
Madam Chair and members, there are three sections passed last session related to child protection, child welfare. They were in Senate File 2902 and House File 3265, and it was signed into law in Chapter 188. The first section amended the Department of Human Services Licensing Act, specifically the provision requiring training for foster care license holders, requiring that annual training include at least 1 hour of training on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. The second section amended the North Star Care for Children, requiring the Commissioner of Human Services, in consultation with representatives from communities of color, to review and revise the MAPSE tool, which is the assessment tool used to determine eligibility for benefits under North Star Care for Children, and incorporate the changes into the MAPSE tool that take into consideration different cultures and diverse needs of communities of color.
Thank you, Ms. Weiss. Ms. Sunderman?
And Madam Chair, members, the third section of the bill establishes the Foster Care Sibling Bill of Rights. Subdivision 1 of this section lists the rights of siblings placed in foster care and mainly focused on placement, communication, and visitation rights. Subdivision 2 specifies the interpretation of the rights in Subdivision 1 and provides that the rights do not replace or diminish other rights, liberties, and responsibilities that may exist for children in foster care. Subdivision 3 requires child welfare agency staff to provide a copy of the rights listed in Subdivision 1 to a child with a sibling at the time the child enters foster care, any known adult siblings, and to the foster care provider, and requires that the copy of the rights contain contact information for the Office of the Ombudsman for Families and instructions on how to file a complaint with that office. And finally, it makes the Foster Care Sibling Bill of Rights effective for children entering foster care on or after August 1st, 2018, and makes Subdivision 3 with the notice requirement effective and apply to all children in foster care on August 1st, 2018.
Thank you, Ms. Sunderman. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so we did get a couple of policy things done, and we did already make mention and had a little bit of a discussion about bringing back the training academy concept, which I think is really important that we keep on the burner. But then also one of the funding things that got wrapped up in the end of session stuff too, was the 20% withhold that came from that $25 million annual investment. And we shouldn't lose track of that either. That really hasn't been achieving its goals, and we tried to work pretty hard. The Senate had a version of that where we would restore that, and it allowed for counties to just have a lot more certainty in their budgeting and whatnot, and we did allow for 20% to go into training and enhancement activities in that vein too. So that'll be coming back as well. So there's a couple of pieces left undone is my point.
Thank you, Senator Lurie, and that's a great point. Ms. White, is there anything else that you can think of that was in that omnibus bill that perhaps we need to bring back or we missed between the two things?
Madam Chair, members, I think those were two of the biggest things in that omnibus bill. I'm not sure if House staff recalls anything additional.
Yes, Ms. Hayden, or Sunderman.
Off the top of my head, I think those were the main provisions in the omnibus bill that didn't
Thank you. Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we worked awfully hard last year to get a task force to look at this issue that I have been talking about all day today around African-American children disproportionately being in the system, as well as the disparity, the issues around decision points and them getting harsher treatment or alleged harsher treatment than the broader population. We need to really kind of figure that out, get the data, do some analysis on that, and either say it's happening and then do something about it, or say that the data doesn't support it and then move on. So we worked awfully hard to get a task force to look at that. Somehow, as it traveled through and went through the conference committee process, it was dropped, stricken, it went away, and then everything went away anyway. So so hopefully we can spend some time on it. I will kind of shout out a town hall meeting that I'm going to have in my district on this issue this Thursday to kind of bring community members along. But I am hearing about this more and more in an increasing way. And I think that it is something that is not just important, though we talk about it in the context of African-American, American Indian children. It really is a weight, for lack of a better term, on the system, something that is like the donkey elephant in the room, if you will. So I think we really need to hopefully bring that task force in, allow us to work closely with the department to gather the data with the counties and figure out what we should do.
Thank you, Senator Hennig. And I hope it's not the donkey and the elephant issue. I hope it's just an issue that we can all work together on. Thank you. Super. Okay, with that, I would like to invite up Ms. York and Ms. Jeskin.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. And
welcome,
members.
Ms. York.
Thank you for your time today.
Absolutely.
Ms. Jeskin will not be able to be here today, so.
Okay. So please proceed. Thank you.
My name is Laura York, and I'm the director of White Earth Indian Child Welfare. And today I would like to talk about White Earth Indian Child Welfare and the initiative. So White Earth Indian Child Welfare has requested additional funding from DHS since 2005 to cover the out-of-home placement costs that were underestimated at the beginning of the initiative. We still have not received an increase in funding since that time. Our agency has worked hard in reducing those costs and placement of our children and have success stories from the Gijuaso program along with the Moms and Mats program. However, the placement cost still continues to rise. Our placement cost is $5 million and we receive $1.3 million through the initiative. One of our recommendations is to be added to the state statute 477A.0126. which would allow the non-4E share to be covered the same as the county. White Earth would also like to respectfully request continued funding for prevention programs, the Gijuaso program, and possible funding for the Moms and Mats program in the future. The success of our Gijuaso program, which was created from the disparities grant, and we began that program November 1st, 2016, which is currently still going on. During that time, we've helped 67 families and 166 children that were referred to the Guijuwaso program. 19 of those children went from the prevention program to the child protection program. But there was 147 that were prevented. So 147 children prevented from ever entering that child protection system or entered into foster care. The success with the MOMS program, the Maternal Outreach Mitigation Service program, the program started in June 2015 as an intervention for pregnant mothers who are addicted to opiates to help our mothers in a non-judgmental treatment environment safely give birth to their children and continue to parent existing children. The MOMS program was able to curb the amount of heroin-positive births on the reservation at an astonishing positive rate, positively impacting the child welfare and foster care system. The MOMS program quickly expanded services at the request of the community to include new mothers with children under 18 months and their male partners. Our original program operates in the village of Nadewash, but it has expanded in 2017 to a second site in Minneapolis. The original MOMS program has been in existence for 3 years and includes the following success points. Successful graduates, 32 successful graduates. 4 parent couples successfully graduated. Parenting children, 42 children have successfully reunified who were previously in the foster care prior to the parents starting the MOMS program. 42 children remained at the home and never entered care. Employment. There was 21 graduates that are employed full-time. 8 of the graduates work at Behavior Health as substance use disorder counselors, counselor aides, security, administrative assistants, peer support workers, and intake workers. 2 graduates work for the tribe in other areas. 3 graduates work for the Shooting Star Casino, and 8 graduates work outside of the tribe. For the MATS program, the medication-assisted treatment services, the White Earth MATS program started in 2016 as a spinoff of the MOMS program at the request of the community. The MATS program assisted all individuals who are suffering with an opioid use diagnosis by offering medication-assisted treatment services in a holistic service program. The services were mandated for participants and included medical case management, mental health services, culturally based services, and substance abuse treatment. Weekly clinical team meetings are performed to track attendance, participation, progress, and concerns of participants. White Earth MATS program operate in the village of White Earth, Nadewash, the city of Bemidji, and Minneapolis. The White Earth MAT program was first to open in 2016 with Nadewash, Bemidji, and Minneapolis following in 2017. The successes of that program, the successful graduates, 65 successful MAT graduates at our White Earth and Nadewash sites. For parenting children, 43 children have successfully been reunified who were previously in foster care prior to the parents starting the MATS program. 64 children remained at home and never entered into the foster care system. Employment, there's 49 graduates obtained full-time employment. 16 of the graduates work with Behavior Health as substance use disorder counselors, counselor aides, security, administrative assistants, peer support workers, and intake workers. There's 33 graduates work outside of the tribe. White Earth started the MOMS and MATS program without any assistance from the state. It was our own initiative, our child welfare intervention initiative, to address the opiate crisis. So again, our request is for 2 requests. One of the recommendations is to be added to that state statute, and the other recommendation would be to respectfully request continued funding for prevention programs. And that is what I have for you today. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'll do the best that I can to answer.
Thank you, Ms. York. Yes, very good to see you again. I do have a question. You started the MATS program, you said, with no assistance from the state. Where did you get your assistance then?
Well, actually, that's a question I'm going to have to get back to you on, because the MATS program and the MOMS program falls under behavioral health, and that would be Jerry Jaskin's division.
I see. Okay. So the question of where, could you also ask her where she would like to see that program developed, how more she would like to see that developed, and in what arena, what capacity, and are there other tribes that are asking for help, assistance in developing their own program?
Yes, I will ask her those questions.
That'd be great.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. York, for being here. And I'll just, before I ask my question, I rode up in the elevator with Ms. York and noticed her beautiful beaded earrings. So if anybody gets a chance to look at those, they're gorgeous. I love beadwork. Just a quick question, and I apologize if I missed this, but could you remind us what the acronyms MATS and MOMS stands for?
Yep.
Ms. York.
MOMS program is Maternal Outreach Mitigation Services, and MATS is Medication Assisted Treatment Services.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And also remind me again how many tribes or areas has these programs have these moved into? Sorry, I get my English correct here.
Ms. York.
So the areas for the MATS program is White Earth, Natawash, City of Bemidji, and Minneapolis. And the MOMS program is in Natawash, Minneapolis, I thought it was in White Earth as well, but for sure Minneapolis and Natawash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more?
Yes, Representative.
All right, thank you. And just it sounds like they're very interesting programs and are having some impact. Do you have plans then to move them out into more areas? Like, is there an incremental plan, or is it just upon request, or how does that work,
Mr.
York, expanding these programs?
I believe these programs have already expanded in a short time, and I do know that there's a lot of folks reaching out to Jerry Jaskin about how the program started and how to get it implemented. I believe she had people throughout the state and even nationally approach her on how to start a program such as this. And like I said before, it was at the community's request. So it's something the community had said that that was working for them, and it was helping keeping our families together. It's helped bring down those placement rates of our children. And just one quick example, if I could. We had a mom who was using heroin, IV user, and she delivered twins. And we went out and offered her the services and said, if you go through the services, there would be no placement. And now she has several months of sobriety. The children never entered into the child protection system, and she is now employed by behavioral health. So to me, that's a very strong, powerful success story. So kind of gives you an idea of the Gija Waso program, what type of folks are we reaching out to, and who are we saying, who's in this like pool of prevention cases. And it's very difficult cases in those that are using opiates. And like I said before, it's something that we've created to try to help our people, you know. And it wasn't necessarily that the assistance was there with the Gija Waso program. The disparities grant was there, thankfully, to get that part going, but to combine MATS and MOMS and a child protection agency together to collaboratively prevent placement of children, I think is where our true success really is.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ms. York, I do have a question for you. The legislative body has done a tremendous amount of work on the opiate issue, and we were unsuccessful last year, but can you just tell us, you know, unfortunately, I think the Native American story gets lost a little bit, and so can you just tell us where it's at right now? At the reservations, what's happening, just because we do have a little bit of time, you know, so I would like to just get apprised of, you know, where we're at with this crisis.
Sure. So I think something that makes White Earth unique is the culturally specific services that are offered to our families. Our healing ceremonies, sweat lodge, the cedar ceremonies, which is a ceremony for grief and loss. Those services, you know, we use our medicines, and those medicines we can grow naturally and access naturally. So when we're working with our families, we show them and we teach them about these things that work help or that work for us and help us with different types of coping mechanisms. It's a natural resource, so when our agencies step out, they're able to go and get those things on their own. And then also, they know who the folks are to provide those ceremonies, and those ceremonies really significantly impact positively the Native American population. And those things are which I believe makes the Moms and Mats program very unique.
So can you tell us about the opioid situation, heroin issue? Is there enough work in there at the reservation level to
make that impact?
Is it growing still, or is it somewhat containable?
Well, the measurement tools that they use to provide to the opiate summit, for example, they bring in different like a picture of the state, and it shows how many, you know, this is a heroin problem. And then Minowamin County, for example, is maroon or like bright red. It looks like it's the worst problem ever, you know. Mm-hmm. So then I asked the question, how are you measuring this? And they said, well, these are the folks that are doing the assessments. Mm-hmm. So what that tells me is, yes, it's bright red because there's a problem, but if they're measuring it by those that are going to get help, you can also see that same picture as that's a really positive thing, because those are folks that are going out and reaching and accessing those services.
Mm-hmm. Where's the drugs coming from? Can I ask?
Everywhere. I believe that the drugs are coming from everywhere. When I say everywhere, I mean, you know, they could be, you know, there's a lot of drugs coming in from Minneapolis and Chicago and wherever else, you know, but I don't think I could specifically say where exactly they're coming from.
Mm-hmm. My colleagues here to my right know that in my district, it's methamphetamine is back big. It's not so much the opiate issue. And are you seeing anything different than heroin and opiates?
Well, we have seen an increase in the methamphetamines as well. One of the things that I would like to say, it's pretty much my personal opinion, not necessarily related to the programming, is that the addiction is an addiction, and if you can find the root of why folks are using and why they've had these tools, and if we can get on that end of it with the prevention, then we could prevent generations to come. That's why culturally specific services and those types of things are so powerful to our folks. So before drugs and alcohol and addictions were in place, we had these tools and medicines and ceremonies that helped us feel good about who we are, know who we are and where we came from. And then also we have our way of life, and that's from birth all the way through. So there's teachings, you know, with our moms when they're pregnant and we have our babies in utero, and there's songs that go with that. And then there's rites of passage when they're teenagers that teaches you about abstinence and you know, teen parenting and self-respect and respect for others and all of these teachings that go with that. Now, if we implemented those culturally specific services and ceremonies and teachings, then we're going to get ahead of why are we using to begin with. So whether it be methamphetamines or heroin or cocaine or alcohol, if we can get to the root of the problem and issue and help provide those services that teach and have those things, that's where we're going to see us positively impacting the generations to come.
Right, and if Representative Kreesh, I'll get to you. And if I understand from Mr. Sorensen, that Casey Family Program will take the recommendations from the tribes to develop an appropriate prevention program. That's wonderful. Representative Kreesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. York, what you just said there, transcends every culture. And I'm glad you brought that, because everything that we are seeing, there's the lines of intersection, which have probably happened for a long time between child protection and chronic addiction, I mean, it's so clear. And I'm wondering, and I don't know if you have an answer, but I mean, this is really what it is how do we get back to filling that void at a very young age so it doesn't manifest itself into a drug addiction or some other artificial way of trying to resolve a loss of something that happened in early childhood. I mean, what you just talked about there, and I don't know that we can do it legislatively. I know we can talk about it, but I mean, what you just said there about the way you treat your young and grow those families culturally, I think we can look across the table here. We all have those in our cultures, and how do we get back to those? We wouldn't need a table of this many people if we could figure that out.
Mr. York.
So something that you could do legislatively would be recognize that those that provide our culturally specific services be recognized as the same as like a medical provider or something along those nature. See, and you're right, everybody has their story about, you know, how are you brought up and what type of, like, who do you identify with and that type of thing. But I can only speak to what I know. And what I know is that with every step of the way through our life is a ceremony, a teaching, and those things that bring us through our life story. And those start before you get here. And that's why the moms program is so important. We're working with our moms on how to be healthy, and they're learning the ceremonies and the teachings before baby gets here. You know, we have our moms and our dads making regalia and moccasins and picking medicines, and our little ones are following along and watching those things. They're learning those things. They're picking those things up. And if we teach them the tools right now as they're growing, that's how it's going to positively impact the future. And that's how it's going to break your cycle of child protection and placement and addictions and all of those things, because you're setting that groundwork right at that very before they get here as they're entering into this world.
Senator Hayden. Senator Hayden, I do have a question for you. Did your task force, it was African American and Native American, is that correct?
Well, Madam Chair, the task force I had was for African Americans, and it was okay. We have a bill, the African American Child Welfare Act, which is pretty much a blueprint of what they did with ICWA, with different delineations because of the political considerations of the American Indian community. So we are following in that same vein, but wanted to focus in on that because there has been so much work done in the American Indian community. So, but I do have a question for our testifier, and I know Representative Cresha is in, is Ms. York. Can you just tell us, I really like what you're saying, but can you help us understand what poverty or the lack of economic development or the lack of jobs and money, however you want to think about it, how that impacts the communities that you live in as it relates to child welfare and addiction?
Sure. Well, poverty is a stressor. You have to you provide for your family. And there again, I think, like I was saying earlier, we can grow our medicines that are natural. We can go out and we can harvest those things. We can provide for our families. And I'll give you two examples really quick. We had a father who had 9 children, and he was near a suspension of parental rights. And he came into our programming. He's successful. Or part of our Gijawaso program is prevention of reentry. So we focus on preventing the kids from entering back into care. When that father went into that prevention of reentry, he successfully completed. And afterwards, when we closed out the case, he the next fall had to provide clothing for all of those kids, for the 9 children. And so you would think, well, how is he going to do this? Because, you know, it's hard. It's hard to work for, it's hard to be a single parent and work and provide for 9 children. Because even if you're working, you don't have childcare necessarily for all of them. And if you do, there goes all of your check and you have this little bit amount left, right? So what this father did was went and harvested one of those natural medicines. And he brought it to the different programs that needed these medicines. And he was able, by doing that, going out picking the sage with his children, was able to raise $3,000 to purchase school clothes. That's identifying your natural resources. He taught, the program helped learn or helped teach him where to access these things, how to grow them, all of the teachings with that. He brought his children with, they were able to help, and then he gave back to the community. That would be one example. Another example would be a family who goes and harvests wild rice, but they're not able to get out there because they need a push pole. So if you invest $12 in the bill for the push pole and $35 knockers, he or she is able to go out and harvest that rice. Well, when they go and harvest that rice, they can make $300 to $500 in a day. And he or she sells the rice back to the community. There again, teaching the children how to go and get your natural resources in your food. You're able to sell it into the community, which is helping the community. And then also you're earning that way of income to be able to pay for your bills or whatever it is. And that's just in one day. And I know, racing is just a week or so, but every change of the season, there's always going to be those different things, and that's where I said that's the importance of our culture and our identity, our way of life, our natural supports. So then that way we can go away from those systems or being dependent on systems, but it's going to take time, and one of the most important things I think is if folks were educated on what that is and how important those things are. So when we ask for recognition of our spiritual advisors or folks that are helping our people by doing those ceremonies, that be recognized. And then also that the services that we're providing are preventing, the placement of children, that it's helping our families learning these different tools and coping mechanisms, and it's making our families healthy again.
Great. Yes, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think when we look at child protection and out-of-home placement and foster care, there's two entities here. And some of it is exactly what you talk about. When you talk about the stressors, we talk about, we're learning more about now ACEs, which is adverse childhood experiences, that the experiences that we encounter as a child impacts who we are as adults. We're learning about those trauma-informed policies that create different practices, which is more of a preventive type of initiative, and stressors that are impacting our lives every single day. And when you couple that with having culturally specific or appropriate programming for families, that matters. Self-identity and recognizing the value that you have as an individual in your family, in your community, and how that interacts with, whether you can hold a job or whether you're homeless or all those stressors that come with life is relevant. But we also have the other piece where we have a system where we had Mr. Sorensen talk about that they hired 415 new employees who are not being trained, who where the waiting should be at least 6 months, but it's so much more because they just don't have the resources. That impacts a new worker who comes into the Native American family community or home or African American home, and they have biases, whether they are unconscious biases or whatever that may be, and they make a decision about whether or not the services, whether a child should be pulled out of the home, or whether or not support services should be given to that family, because the family may just need, if it's not an opiate crisis or a meth crisis or whatever, because that would be automatically put out, a child being pulled out of the homes. But sometimes it's just as simple as that they may need a refrigerator or in the house or maybe a wash machine in the home or some type of support services. So it's twofold. It is those stressors that it's real. It's about that cultural piece that I would say definitely the African-American community and the Native American community needs, the programming that is needed to support them to overcome those challenges, but also the realization that we have a system now that are disproportionately pulling kids out of their homes, and kids who are lingering now in out-of-home placement in 2014 and 15, which that was 175 days, which is still a very long time, to now where we have kids who are lingering in the system 297 days. And not only is that trauma on the families, on the parents, but that is trauma on the kids who are disconnected from their family, from their community, and everything they know. So we are in a crisis. And when there's a crisis, there's a triple crisis that's happening with Black and Native American families in this state and also around this country. And so I agree with you when you say that you're having some great outcomes. You know, outcomes are really connected to that cultural piece that specifically you are doing to help your community, help those families, help those individuals know the value of who they are and what that means, and traditionally how they're supposed to interact in life and in different spaces. So I just want to also just say thank you and thank your organization for the work that you're doing to create the great outcomes that you are seeing happening, and having others come to you to say, how can we replicate this, not only where we are, but in many other spaces. That is absolutely awesome, good work. And hopefully at the state, that at the state level, that we can take in some of this without being offended about sometimes people need to be able to validate who they are as individual and say it works. It works.
Thank you, Representative Moran.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. York, too. Thank you for coming. Thank you for your work. You've been at this a very long time, and very good to get an update and see what you need to assistance from us going forward. So thank you.
Sounds great. Thank you all.
And for the public, there is the documents are posted on the website, the task force website, if you'd like to have any of these documents. Members, I think that's about it for today. Representative Krisha and I have been talking about going forward. He will have the gavel next time. And just stay tuned. We are going to be working very diligently on this issue before session to make sure that we have a game plan going forward, basically. Excuse me. Senator Matthews, what?
Madam Chair, is there a date set yet?
No, there is not a date, and we will need to. You think so? No, probably not. We will have to talk. Okay. With that, meeting is adjourned.